This is the Middle Chamber Books Podcast, episode number 41, for Monday, November 9th, 2015. In this episode of the Middle Chamber Books and Music Podcast, a conversation with author Shel Israel. He's got a new book out. It's called Lethal Generosity, and it talks about the things that companies need to do to keep their customers happy and coming back to buy more products. Welcome to the Middle Chamber Books and Music Podcast. I'm your podcast host, Steve Lubetkin, and the bookseller at middlechamberbooks.com. In this podcast, we present interviews with authors and creative professionals talking about their work. On this episode of the Middle Chamber Books Podcast, we talk with Shel Israel. Israel is a writer, a speaker, and by his own admission on his website, a nice guy. Shel is an author who discusses technology's impact on business and life. He started his career as a newspaper reporter in the 1960s and says he eventually came to hate the vow of poverty connected to journalism. As a former journalist, I can relate to that. In the 80s, he turned to public relations and had a technology PR firm in Silicon Valley, which he sold to its employees in 2001. And he now describes himself as a recovering publicist. He's written three books. His first two were Naked Conversations and The Age of Context, which he co-wrote with Robert Scoble, who used to be a technology evangelist at Microsoft and is now a technology evangelist on his own. And the third book, Lethal Generosity, just came out, and the three books form a trilogy talking about the amazing changes that technology's imposed on work and life over the past 10 years. Now, while the first two books looked primarily at technology, Lethal Generosity looks more closely at the changes taking place in retail and other public-facing enterprises like stadiums, airports, and shopping districts. Shel Israel, it's great to have you on the Middle Chamber Books and Music Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Steve. Good to talk again.
Thank you. So the new book is Lethal Generosity. Where in the world did you get the idea for that title?
That's a long story. I tell it in the book, actually, but of course I'd love to tell it here in abbreviated form. The idea might have started in a bar with Robert Scoble, as so many of my good ideas used to. And that was when he told me about his first job working in a camera store, where people would come in looking for a camera and say, yeah, I have that camera, but the guy around the corner selling it at 20% off right now, he's got a sale going on. People would look at him amazed, go around the corner. They'd come back usually and they'd say, you are so nice. I just got the camera I wanted and it was 20% off, as you said. And now that I have it, I need a tripod, I need a case, I need that old technology called film. And they bought it from Scoble. And the next time they'd come in, they'd have a friend come in with them who brought friends over in time. I said, Robert, where'd you get this idea? He said, actually, I got it from my boss, who is this old Jewish guy. And he'd say, look, the smart thing to do is lose the sale and gain a customer. And I started thinking that there were other cases of that. And it kind of stuck with me till I got up a few years later to Twitterville, a book I wrote in 2009. It was about a different Twitter than most of us now know. And in Twitterville, I found out a story about Molson Ale, who, when Twitter just came out, found out that the city of Montreal, where they were based, was a hard hit on the budget. So the city decided they couldn't afford the safety-based service of free transportation on New Year's Eve. Molson jumped in and said, well, it's only $80,000. We think that people, the business community in this city, should put this money up to help our government out, and most certainly to allow this safe New Year's Eve in Montreal. And we call upon Labatt's, their closest competitor, to please join us in this campaign and match our $20,000. They did this on their blog first, and then they had half a dozen, mostly young people, tweeting while working for Molson, and they started putting it out. And the word went everywhere in a short period of time on Twitter. So what happened was Labatt's kept doing what they were doing, and their customers were on Twitter talking with other customers about what was becoming known as the Molson Challenge, a term Molson never invented. And about a week later, the story finally made it into the local traditional news, and it ran on page one of the biggest paper in Montreal. And in the headline was, of course, the Molson Challenge to Labatt's. Now, this was fascinating to me because Labatt's was put into a position of impossibility. If they took the Molson Challenge, they were following the thought leadership of a competitor, which is something you really don't want to do. But if they did not take the Molson Challenge, they were going to be in the position of not supporting responsible drinking in their hometown.
It's sort of letting themselves be painted into a corner.
Yeah, it was actually on Molson's part what I called in Twitterville an act of lethal generosity. Joe Thornley, who you may know, who has a PR firm up that way, he's in Ottawa actually, he said, this is really a great idea. You should write a book about it. It's a great idea. And I spent a couple of months trying to gather stories of lethal generosity, and I couldn't. There weren't enough. The technology was new. We were up to the point where Twitter was what we were all using, and Facebook was something for Ivy League frat boys to find dates on Friday night. So we weren't paying much attention to it just yet. Today, there are many, many stories of it, which is what the book is really about. Lethal Generosity is a sequel to my last book with Robert Scoble, where we talked about the convergence of five technologies into creating a new force in the marketplace where technology would become our most trusted companion and our most knowledgeable companion. And it would enable businesses to give us uniquely wonderful experiences. This was really faith-based a couple of years ago, but just about a month after we finished that book, Beacons came out, and the world started changing and kept changing very, very quickly.
And you see this in the fact that millennials are almost nonstop glued to their smartphones wherever you go.
That is very central to this book. This book is dedicated to millennials. I call them the last hope we have. And that means that if they are as good as I think they are, there is hope that this planet will continue for the next 50 years while the millennials dominate the marketplace. And of course, if I'm wrong, no one will be around to tell me I was wrong. So I think I win both ways.
Well, I know the millennials are very socially conscious because as they were growing up, they were community projected to death in school and in the organizations they belong to.
They're actually, what's important to me about them is they're the first generation of digital natives to reach the workplace. And they act and operate differently than earlier generations as employees, as customers, and watch out, folks, as competitors.
What are some of the differences?
Well, for one thing, the rest of us acquired an ability to use technology. For them, it was as natural as learning a language. I came across a study that showed that people, when they learn a language before they reach the age of puberty, they speak it without an accent. They can learn three, four, or even five of them. But for those of us who learned other languages after puberty, don't ask me why puberty is the benchmark. We always have some kind of an accent. And this interested me because my mother got here, I guess, before puberty. She had no accent. And my father got here shortly afterwards at age 15. And he had an accent all his life. That's how we, who are older than them, use technology. There's still something foreign about it. Even if we're proficient at it, it isn't natural.
There's also almost an apologetic attitude if you use technology. A lot of baby boomers are like, well, I don't know my computer, I don't understand it, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we aging boomers for business decision makers are becoming less and less important just based on the law of nature. We're not going to be around that much longer, and the millennials are the next generation to come along that will dominate marketplace, culture, thinking, politics, and everything else the way we have for the last 30 or 40 years.
So they use the technology differently, and they like to do things that have a commerce component and a social component.
They see themselves as part of the Internet of Things, and they are connected to each other and to other things. They see this technology and networking and collaboration as the solution to just about all things. They see it as the shortcut to getting to the solution faster. And they are entirely uncomfortable when you take the technology away from them, as opposed to us, where we get a little more comfortable when we're just sitting around, two of us, maybe bending an elbow in a bar and not leaning into our texting and our Facebooking and our mobile devices.
And so they tend to collaborate more, and they tend to be more interested in using the technology for social good.
Yes. And when they start businesses, they use technology in ways that those of us who are older never thought of.
What are some of the examples of businesses you found when you dug into it?
Well, there are three categories of businesses. I think I probably named about 30 or 35 different examples of millennial businesses that are doing amazing things to treat their customers with greater generosity and therefore lock out the competition, which is what the title comes from. The more you treat your customers well, the more you screw your competitors. The millennial businesses are coming down into three categories. The first is the best known, which is called the sharing economy. But I didn't find it to be essentially about sharing. I found it to be more about the efficiencies of software platforms in competing with traditional brick and brand-based companies. In this model, the sharing economy companies have an enormous advantage in that they see the customer as the marketing channel. We decide whether you're going to go with this driver or stay in this guy's weekend getaway based on what his past customers told us or her past customers told us. So that's one. Second is related to it very closely, and that's cause-based marketing. The model there is Tom's Shoes, which I think lots of people by now have heard of. But here's a guy who didn't do very much for the world at all until he found himself in a South American village where he was taken aback by the pain and suffering that children who were barefoot were undergoing. And he started this company where every time somebody buys a pair of Tom's Shoes in a fashionable store in Midtown Manhattan, another pair of shoes is given to a poor kid somewhere in the world. And in the times that they've been around, I could have my number wrong, but I think they've given 45 million pairs of shoes to people. The important thing is they don't advertise much at all. They just go around talking about these programs. And the customers don't talk much about how these shoes go so nicely with the dress they're wearing. They hear the words nice shoes and they tell the story about cause-based marketing.
And they're more interested in the cause than they are in
yes,
in the shoes. It's interesting.
Absolutely. And the cause becomes the marketing and the channel becomes the customer.
And it still sells more shoes.
In Nordstrom, San Francisco, Tom's pushed Nine West off the prime real estate in the women's shoe department about 2 years ago. that's where I started paying attention to Times, because here's Nine West, who has all these really racy ads, questionable sexism in it, but they were doing rather well. And they had this central display in Nordstrom's 1 month, and they came back a month later to buy running shoes in the next apartment over. And I noticed that Tom's had replaced Nine West right in the prime real estate.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, anyone who has stood on a street corner in Midtown Manhattan at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and tried to hail a cab has to be turning backflips over the availability of Uber as an option, because at the shift change time in New York, all the cabs are rushing back to the cab garages.
Uber is an example of a very important point of the book, that in the old days, it was brand the built trust, and they told us why we should trust them. And now here's a company that comes along that in almost anybody's judgment has not behaved with a great sense of executive responsibility and niceness. But what they have done is create an incredible experience. We call it Uberizing experience, where they allow the drivers and the passengers to rate each other. And this is how each of us gets better. If you borrow from the back of an Uber, you're going to stand there paging all day long and not get anyone. And if you're a driver that demonstrated your version of New York City a road rage, you're probably not going to get anybody to get into the back of your car. So that's one. But two, the most amazing thing, which is world-changing when you play it out, is the ability of when you reach your destination, you just hop out. You don't pay. You don't sit there with the stupid slider in the back of the seat. It never works right. You just get out.
It's a much better experience.
Yes, and experience trumps brand every time these days. And as my generation, who some of which are old enough that they still prefer dispatchers and taxi cabs for mysterious reasons, no one else does. And everyone else wants this better experience. Now taxi cab drivers are trying to do something, not companies, are trying to Uberize their experience. They're trying to get mobile apps. But they don't have the culture. They don't have all the standards that Uber has set up. I advise every kind of older company to Uberize whatever they can, is how hotels are fighting Airbnb, which I talk about a good deal in the book.
That was my question, is are the old line companies able to be nimble enough to learn from these new companies, from this new economy?
I'll use the journalistic, that remains to be seen. My answer really is that some will, and there are enormous advantages to brand. Marriott, Hyatt, and Hilton are brands that most of us trust, as particularly when we go somewhere that we've never been. I still use hotels in those cases. But I'm using Airbnb whenever I go to a location. That's an aside. The answer to the question is all of these hotels are now experimenting with Uberizing a few things. There are pilot programs where you can use a mobile app to check into a hotel. Last time I was in Europe, I used an NFC card instead of a door key to get into my room. Next time I'm there, I'm very sure that I'll be using a mobile app, wave it in front of my door, and the door will open for me. The bar will do the same thing for me. I'll probably be able to wave it and turn the TV on. And the idea of contactless payments, which started with the technology underneath Uber, which is it's a company called Braintree, and it's available to any other company, allows people to do things they've never done. It allows people to walk out of stores with goods they've actually bought. And the charge rings up as they go through this, go past a sensor at the door. And that's that. They don't have to stand in a checkout line. They don't have to put up their credit card. They don't have to slide it through and hear, please try that again. They don't have to find out whether this store is using the new chip, which is slower than the old, slower but more secure than the old strip. They just walk out, and we're going to have more and more of that.
Why do you think it's so hard for very large companies that employ a lot of, you know, in most cases, very smart people to do their marketing and their customer outreach? Why do you think it's so hard for them to break through and do the kinds of things that these startups, this sharing economy collection of companies has been able to do?
Great question. The wisest answer I probably have is I don't know, but I can guess. Large things have troubles moving as fast as little things. Okay, a large person doesn't move with the agility in a race as a smaller person or a thinner person. Large companies are like that. They have many layers of decision-making to go through before they can do something. Around the corner, there's somebody who thinks that what they're doing can be done better, and there's five of them, and they're desperate, and they have a round of seed financing, and they better prove it in the marketplace before they run out of money in 6 months. So there is a real little guy advantage to adopting new ways. The large company is locked into this death pill called best practices. A best practice is based on copying something another company did in the past. So now you're making your model to follow a thought leader who has probably moved on to something else.
I was going to say, it's almost a recipe for failure because it's already a couple of years old by the time you do it.
Yeah, and the whole opportunity is to use technology to create better practices so your competitor has to follow you, putting you in a position of Molson and them in a position of Labatt's.
So what is the recipe for success? What's the takeaway for the large company from looking at the lethal generosity of the smaller companies?
Uberize as much as you can.
Streamline the process.
Use the technology to give customers an exquisite experience at every touch point, from the point they're in the parking lot before they get into your store.
Did you come across any examples of companies that are doing that?
I came across companies that are doing a lot of it. Perhaps the best example is being done by a partnership between Esri, one of the world's largest satellite companies, if not the largest. They're the ones the NSA has going over your house. They report when your swimming pool is consistently of the wrong color, showing that you might be under financial stress. And now if you're going to almost any one of the big block stores, the Home Depots, the Lowe's, the Costco's, et cetera, Target, Walmart, Walgreens. When you go over their stores, people who have enrolled in the loyalty program, when they get out of the car, the satellite spots you, it reports it to the store. The store brings up your data, discovers you come in every other Saturday afternoon because look at that, you're building a deck. So you walk out of the parking lot, and the store knows this before you go through the door. When you go through the door, you're using an Esri 411 internal map to go through the store to the lumber department, which is your destination. As you go and you pass by where paints are, you get a little signal saying, "Hey, Steve, we've got a special on redwood stain that you're going to need for your new deck. Would you like some?" And so now you're getting what I call pinpoint marketing. You're getting an offer for something you weren't thinking of buying that you need to buy at a place where you're located at the time and at a deal that is preferable to what would happen if you waited 2 weeks.
We're starting to see a little bit of this. It sort of was predicted or previewed in the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report.
Yeah.
When he's walking through the mall and the screens are giving him ads that were targeted at him.
those incredibly weird things of, what, a dozen years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
Are becoming a reality in more and more places.
And I see this, it's a little bit not perfected on websites. You know, I'll go buy a piece of equipment for my business or a piece of technology, and then the next time I hit Facebook, it'll have an ad for exactly the product I bought.
Yeah, I forgot what that's called, but this...
But it's kind of too late because I already bought it.
This is a common practice. How about when you tell the world on Facebook that you're looking for a place to stay next weekend on the Jersey Shore?
Right.
And then even the place where you've stayed will keep making you offers to come back for the rest of your natural life.
Right. You just reminded me, you know, with the example about going to Home Depot, of an experience that I remember from when I was very young and went on a trip with my parents to Canada. We stayed at at the Queen Elizabeth II Hotel in Montreal, where they had a wonderful dinner club there. And we went for dinner. The waiter's name was Paul, and my dad ordered a Tanqueray martini. And we had a fabulous dinner. And before the end of our trip, my mom says to my dad, "What, you know, our last night in Montreal, what do you want to do for dinner?" And my dad says, "Oh, I want to go back to the same restaurant." So we go back to the restaurant. We walk in the door. And mind you, the waiter had only seen my father once in his life, about a week before. He looks at my father and he goes, "Ah, Mr. Lubetkin, your usual martini, sir?"
Now, that's exactly what we all want. That's a great story.
Right. And he got a big tip that night.
Yeah. Yeah. We are generous to those who treat us generously.
Exactly.
We do this throughout life. And when companies start realizing that the power has shifted, that we influence each other, and the technology is where they can see what we're saying about them. But what you just described, actually, Rob and I discussed in the last book, and that's we want to be somewhere where everybody knows our name. We want to walk in and the hotel remembers that this is your favorite drink, that you like a room at the top of the hotel with a view. We want to be known that way, and we stop worrying about what's going on with our data when the data is used to make us happier. When we are happier, we tell our friends not to serve that restaurant, not to serve that hotel, but to serve our friends.
And that is the core of the kind of economic exchange that this data allows.
Yep.
If it's done right. Shel Israel, the author of Lethal Generosity, I appreciate your taking the time to be on the podcast with us.
Steve, thanks a lot. I had a ball. You asked great questions.
Thank you. Before we go, give us a couple of words about the book and where they can find it.
You can find Lethal Generosity on Amazon.
Is there a website for the book?
Yes, shelisrael.com.
And the book is available on the Amazon Kindle and also in paperback?
And Audible, all three.
Wonderful. We hope you enjoyed this edition of the Middle Chamber Books and Music Podcast. Please visit our Amazon affiliate store at middlechamberbooks.com. If you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, including suggestions for other people you might want to hear an interview with, please write me at steve@middlechamberbooks.com. And don't forget to check out my own book, The Business of Podcasting, which I co-authored with Donna Papacosta, the Toronto-based podcasting pioneer. You can get more information about the book at thebusinessofpodcasting.com. The book's available on the Amazon Kindle and in trade paperback. We'd love to have you take a look and purchase a copy. And as always, our theme music is provided by the Indianapolis Jazz Orchestra. It's called Cook the Books. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts, a division of the Lubetkin Media Companies in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on the web at beingthemedia.com. These programs are copyrighted and may not be reproduced or cross-posted to other websites without express written permission from the copyright owner. If you are interested in sponsoring these programs, they are available for sponsorship. Just drop us an email or call us at 856-751-5491. For everyone at the Middle Chamber Bookstore and in the studios of Professional Podcasts, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.